This is Games as a Podcast.
Today, we're joined by Afzal Kuhner. Afzal was my boss back in the Sega.com days, and he fearlessly led a ragtag, almost greenhorn group to build amazing web technologies and websites that ran on them. Before that, he was at SegaSoft, which made and published PC and Saturn games. While at Sega.com, he was absorbed by the Nokia mothership when the Finnish company acquired Sega.com to help launch their Engaged handheld, which folks might remember. It'll be fun to talk about that a little bit. He then went on to work at various gaming companies, including Gree and Wikia, and he currently works at PlayStation. You might have heard of that company as a director of engineering. I've known him for years, and I've always admired him for his amazing combination of technical and people skills. It's a really rare and much appreciated combination. He's a great boss, and I'm stoked to have him on today. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Great. So I thought it would be fun to kind of start back from the beginning days, if you could talk a little bit about your time at SegaSoft and what you did there. I think a lot of people are fans of Sega, and I think SegaSoft is kind of a lesser known aspect of the kind of Sega Kiritsu.
Yeah. So I started at SegaSoft in, I think, 96, sort of the tail end of Saturn. And I think they'd been doing PC games for a couple years when I started. This is the lead up to the first dot-com bubble. So yeah, it was very interesting. We worked on a bunch of PC titles. There were kind of crazy things that I still kind of can't believe we did in the 90s. One of the main products, in addition to a number of PC games, kind of the standard, you know, late 90s PC games that you might expect, then we also created an online gaming network called Heat.net. And this was, it had crazy features. We had voice chat. We had lobbies, loyalty points. I think even one of the online fighting games had in-game ads. Yeah, it was pretty fun.
It's kind of a good example of how Sega, in many ways, was ahead of the curve, ahead of its time. And I feel like SegaSoft was definitely that. Heat.net certainly preceded kind of the explosion, certainly the dominance of Valve and Steam, and also kind of introduced a lot of things that people take for granted today, like the chat rooms and the lobbies and achievements. I think even was a thing on Heat.net. Pretty amazing.
I remember that the Sega Saturn, even that had a modem. Its functionality was limited, but talk about ahead of the curve. When people talk Sega and online, they usually start the conversation with Dreamcast.
Right.
And that was really foundational to that platform, but really cool that you could actually access a browser on the Saturn itself.
Yeah, and I think even before that, there was on Genesis, I never had one, but on Genesis, I think there was a thing you could connect to your cable coax, and then you could subscribe to the Sega channel.
That's right. Yep. That's right. I was so disappointed that my local Time Warner cable didn't support that because I wanted that so badly. It was really, really cool. And there were some exclusive games on that too, like Mega Man, Wily Wars, stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But Sega's always been on the vanguard of that. And so Heat.net, you said that, did that start with PC?
Yeah.
Or was that console focused from the very beginning?
No, that part of Sega was not, so there was Sega of America and then SegaSoft, and I can't remember, at some point it either was SegaSoft Networks or maybe it turned into SegaSoft Networks, but it was definitely focused on PC gaming and then the online network. And then a little bit later, there was like the Sega.com division where I worked with Chris, and also the Dreamcast division, and we worked very closely together.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember in the Dreamcast days seeing Heat.net as a brand on, say, the NFL 2K box.
Yeah.
NBA 2K.
Yeah, I feel like there was also kind of a... Then it went into SegaNet, so I think a lot of the online DNA maybe got a little bit blurry.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other thing that I distinctly remember that was Sega Soft was Three Dirty Dwarves, which was a favorite of mine in the Saturn era. I don't know if you touched on that one at all professionally.
No, I don't. I didn't. But yeah, there were a lot of interesting games back then. One of my favorites was there was like an airplane flying game called Plane Crazy, just sort of like a plane racing game. We had a bunch of kind of Quake clones, and actually I think there was also like a custom mod for Quake that we made called Da Bomb.
Oh cool.
Yeah. It was pretty fun. You had to like go into the other person's base and like plant the bomb, and then there was a timer or whatever, and it was pretty amazing.
So it sounds like Sega Soft was kind of Wild West.
Yes. We were trying everything. Like many other .com companies, it was like, build it and the money will come eventually, which I don't know that it did. But the technology and kind of user experience was just amazing. It was really fun to work there.
Yeah, that's great. I do remember back when Microsoft decided that broadband was the only way to go with online for consoles.
Yeah.
They were saying, like, doing it before broadband was like trying to eat a pizza through a straw, I think was their comparison. So was it, like, what were the challenges back when you were doing effectively pre-broadband network gaming?
We licensed... So there was a technology called IPX, which was... I think it bridged some kind of, now I don't remember which technology, but there was some like local LAN technology, and then you could connect it through even dial-up internet. And so it was like, you know, the three of us, even if we're in a different place, we would be on a local LAN. And so this was kind of the era of LAN parties, and, you know, you could lug your PC to some warehouse or, you know, whatever, cafeteria, network them together and play Quake. So this was kind of the same thing, but online. It actually worked pretty well. I mean, as I said, even we had a online fighting game called, I think it was called Net Fighter. 1v1. And again, like, think about that over dial-up in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. It was quite fun. Yeah, and then when we were working on Dreamcast... they all shipped with the 56K modem, which, you know, as you said, the dial-up penetration was, it wasn't quite there. Like, in many ways, as Chris said earlier, there were a lot of things Sega did early and sometimes too early. And then for all of the, then there was an additional network adapter that you could buy for Dreamcast.
Oh, right, that was adapter, broadband, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all had a modem, you could take out the modem and then put in a broadband adapter.
I just those remember...
a hot commodity.
Oh, yeah, those were tough to get, I remember.
Yes.
But for me, I remember being so jealous of PC gamers because I was 100% a console gamer, mm-hmm. and as people were playing Diablo and they were playing Doom, I just had no experience with this online stuff until the Dreamcast. That's what broke it for me, and I started playing NBA and NFL, even though I have no interest in watching sports. Playing sports on Dreamcast was a blast for me.
Yeah. You know,
that was a great entry point. Phantasy Star Online was huge for me, too. That was my Diablo, so...
Yeah, I loved PSO. That was great. Yeah, I've played online games like almost my whole life. You can find it, but they were very niche back then, and obviously that's like the kind of the only thing now. I mean, even single player games like Diablo 4, they're all online, and of course there's a big multiplayer component now. But it was very interesting. I've done both. I've gone back and forth between console gaming and PC gaming. Right now, my PC is kind of ancient, so I'm doing all of it on PS5. But Yeah.
Go figure. Go figure. So talking about early, kind of being early to the party, can you talk a little bit about 10-6 and maybe tell folks what that was about? And
speaking of early, so 10-6 was one of the very early online MMOs. The number was 10 to the 6, like a million, and back then we were shocked and amazed and like, really, maybe we can get a million players. So it was I think it was all PvP. The graphics were a lot like the Battlezone arcade game, if you guys remember that, the kind of tank, not the
vector.
Kind of vectory, but this was like a little bit further, very blocky, and you would build a base. People would attack you. I'm pretty sure there were some kind of like clans or groups or something like that. And there were even, I think, in-game purchases called jitter packs and sort of loot boxy. So it was pretty fun. And actually, it's still running right now. Like, it got shut down, and then somehow the source code was around or something happened. Hand wave, and then it's still there.
Wow.
That's
remarkable.
It's a sign of a great service-based game or multiplayer game when they can last decades. And I know people are still playing EverQuest 1.
Yeah.
It's wild that happens.
Yeah, it was so fun. Yeah, I played a multiplayer game in college called Netrek, which is, I think, still barely around. It was on old, like, Unix machines and team versus team. We had a college squad. It was pretty fun.
That's great.
That's amazing. So SegaSoft kind of eventually sort of morphed into Sega.com, which kind of predates me because I joined Sega of America. And then when Sega.com was spinning up, I came downstairs to join the SegaSoftians that were forming up Sega.com. So I'm a little unclear on like kind of the order of operations. Do you remember? Can you recall how that transpired?
So I remember, I mean, there was a big deal when we moved to San Francisco. We were in Redwood Shores, and then we moved to 650 Townsend, which at the time was a big deal because it was a multimedia hub and had a data center in the building with a backup generator on the roof. All of that was to, I think, start working on the Dreamcast and then continue running Heat.net. I don't remember the timing exactly when we shut down or combined, but as you said, I think a lot of the online stuff we were doing in Heat then moved into the backbone for some of it moved into Dreamcast. I do remember when we started Sega.com, I think that was mainly to like relaunch all the online stuff under one umbrella. So that's probably why we incorporated, I guess the marketing and editorial part of Sega of America. It was amazing. And then I think in Sega.com, we also had some of the Dreamcast Online stuff. Like I remember our team worked on the high score and graffiti upload for Jet Grind Radio.
I worked on that directly. Yeah.
You could like create.
We had to make two versions of websites, one for kind of PCs and then Dreamcast compatible sites that people could go to on their Dreamcast. So, and then all the functionality to support, like you said, graffiti creation and upload via you could make actually graffiti on your VMU, I think, and upload it to the Jet Set Radio website. It was a lot of fun.
I loved that game.
Oh yeah, it's a fave.
Yeah. Totally. I think we had another thing where you could, in Sonic Adventure, you had the little chows, and then you could download them to your VMU.
Chow Garden.
Yes.
And then if you wanted to, there was a chow daycare where you could upload your chow to the server, and then I think the fiction was the server would take care of it or something. It would go to daycare, and then it would come back with more experience or items or something like that. That was pretty amazing.
That's a Tamagotchi business model right there.
It has to be both fun and frustrating to be so ahead of the curve, where you see companies literally decades after you've done something introduce a technology idea or solution that you've done already, and they call it brand new. And they say, for the first time ever, we're doing this and that.
Right. Right, right. I mean, there's sort of, yeah, I think it's the same thing in art, is like there's, or philosophy, there's no original ideas. But it is interesting when people are really thinking this is some amazing new thing. And it's like, I hope there's a new spin on it. This could be really cool. Like, yeah, maybe now is the time for whatever the new thing is. But yes, it's not the first time. Nope. For a lot
it's of new to you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm ready for the VMU to come back.
I'm telling you, it was awesome.
I looked at the list of games that are associated with SegaSoft, and there are some favorites like Mr. Bones I loved, and oh, yeah. Bug 2 was one of my favorites as well. So how focused was SegaSoft on the software development side of things versus network infrastructure? Like, where did that balance lie?
Let's see, that's a great question. I think originally it was all software development. I might be wrong, but from what I remember, it was all software development. And then we started to think about how we could connect them and make a better user experience and probably business model with the games and the online piece together so that they could really feed each other. I think, yeah, so when I started in 96, it was just games, and then I can't remember exactly. I think we launched Heat.net in 97 or 98, maybe. And some of the games were online. Many of them had a local kind of a LAN gameplay. But then because we had this technology, you could play LAN games with friends across the country or maybe across the world.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is remarkable. And I just think about how some of the things that were done back then still live. So the online game with Heat.net that I got most into actually was NBA 2K. And that was Visual Concepts. And yeah, while Sega owned them for a long time, they ultimately, as I'm sure you know, were sold to 2K. And they are now still doing the 2K NBA series, which is some of the most popular games every year. They're always in the top five.
Yep.
And they're known most for their online experience. And so it's just cool to see that the seeds that were planted there way back in 99, 2000 still are delivering.
Yeah.
People are still enjoying those experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. They had a beautiful campus, too. I visited them. They used to be somewhere in kind of the North Bay.
Yeah, Marin.
Yeah, their sports games were amazing. I'm not a huge sports guy, and actually the way I finally understood football back in the day was playing NFL probably 2K1 or 2K2. And then that point I was like, oh, okay, now I understand, like, passing and rushing and protecting the quarterback and all those things. I don't know if that's an embarrassing story or a great story, but
no, I think it's great. And something Chris has mentioned in the past about NFL 2K that was so special was the VMU support.
Totally.
So being able to play online, couch co-op, but not let people see your plays.
Exactly.
That's always been a frustrating thing with Madden, where you can't avoid that. But on Dreamcast, you could privately choose those things, and that was a really great advance in digital football.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. There was a lot you could do with a private display on the controller, and then it was also a memory card, and also you could take it out and play mini games. It had a little D-pad and I think two buttons.
Yeah, that is one of those things that does frankly surprise me a bit, that we haven't seen any other company follow up on that idea or technology, because it is so neat. I guess part of it, of course, is that now if you want to carry your experience around, you use the cloud in your phone.
Right,
if anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I did see
save files are probably huge as well.
Yeah,
comparatively.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But I think Sony did have, maybe it was PS2. There is something that looks like a VMU. I don't remember the timing, but yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a key feature for Dreamcast. And I thought it was great.
Little digression here, but one thing that I'm also surprised no one ever tried to follow up on, but I loved it when Sony created an Xperia phone that had a slide out like the PSP Go with game controls.
Yeah.
So you could have the, you know, the four buttons and a digital pad, and you could just slide it in and out. I've always dreamed of like Apple doing an iPhone G that would have that type of functionality. Yeah. No dice.
Yeah. Well, don't hold your breath.
I mean, as you probably know, Nokia tried to do a kind of hero gaming phone, but didn't quite go well.
They sure did. Yeah, that's a good segue. So that was such an interesting time. For me personally, it was interesting because I was a sacrificial lamb offered to Sega of America, which turned out to be an amazing experience for me. And the rest of you folks kind of separated from the mothership and joined Nokia. Obviously, I kept in touch with a lot of you folks, but it'd be interesting to hear your perspective, what it was like during that time to go from being Sega to being Nokia. What maybe some differences in terms of the way the companies operated?
Yeah.
And what was your experience in launching the N-Gage?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of, in some ways, it was going from one mothership to another. At Sega, the mothership is definitely in Japan. And at Nokia, it was clearly in Finland and in Helsinki. And it was funny, because I don't remember if I thought this, but a lot of people think Nokia is a Japanese company. Maybe, I don't know why, just maybe because of the
It sound. Sounds like a Japanese sounds company, like a Japanese. The name.
Sounds like it could be, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe they don't anymore, but yeah, so we were working on mobile games for Sega, and this was sort of right after Dreamcast met an early demise, and we were looking at multi-console strategies. At the same time, there was also a group, and Chris, I think you were part of this too, where we were making Sega mm-hmm. games for mobile phones, mostly in Japan.
Yeah, Brew, JTME.
Yeah. And we would...
Super Monkey Ball.
So good. People would come back from Japan, and they'd have these crazy phone, like flip phones with cameras. Right. And again, like another example of super early, or, you know, kind of what we think is really common technology now. It was amazing to see it so early. So then as part of that, kind of the game development and online gaming network, our part of Sega was sold to Nokia, so we joined them. I still remember when I first saw, after, you know, we signed all of our NDAs and whatever, and we first saw the N-Gage, and we were, like, trying to understand how it would work and look at the prototype. It was pretty surprising how you would have to actually use it. Like, the gaming part was great, but the game switching part was not great.
Didn't you have to take the battery out?
You had to take the battery out and the SIM card out, and then the games would go into the MMC, you know, the memory chip slot, which was under the SIM card slot.
Wow.
So I have some perspective on that, because at the time I was writing for magazines like Electronic Gaming Monthly mm-hmm. and Game Now. So Nokia reps came in and showed us the machine, and we were really impressed with the tech specs.
Right.
And it was amazing to see Tomb Raider and Tony Hawk running on that, because the comparisons were to the Game Boy Advance at the time. DS and PSP were not out yet. So this was like real 3D gaming on a handheld device that was also a phone. Pretty amazing. But I remember the huge hang-up that we ended up having was that you had to switch out those cartridges and remove the SIM card and the battery, as you said. And the explanation that they gave us was, well, if you're playing a game like Tomb Raider, we're expecting that players are just going to put it in and leave it in until they finish it and then move to the next game. And that's just not how players play. It's like you want to play a little Tomb Raider, then you want to move on to Tony Hawk in the same game session. And that was a pain.
Yeah. The business model and user experience actually reminds me a lot of Dreamcast, because we were just a few years too early. Like, the technology and networks and user behavior wasn't quite there for buying over the air and downloading. It was still very much you go to the retail store and you buy your yeah. CD or DVD. So
physical product.
Physical product. Yeah. I mean, I think the cases, I think they were pretty close to the size of a Game Boy case, but similar to a Game Boy game, the case was huge and then the game itself was very small, you know, the size of a memory card. So that was a little bit tricky. And then the other thing, the speakers were on the top, speaker and microphone, so you kind of had to hold it sideways. There's a very early meme site called Side Talking. I think it's still up. Pretty funny.
Yep. Well, and boy, they put so much marketing effort and publishing effort into making this thing work. So there were ads everywhere, and the brands that they got signed on, there was a Call of Duty for it.
Yeah. I mean,
Civilization, Crash Nitro Kart, Sega Rally, Sonic the Hedgehog, Metal Gear, Splinter Cell. There was Tony Hawk, as I said. Like, all the biggest brands that existed at the time, it seemed, made their way to the N-Gage.
Yeah, and the games were great. It was, I played a lot of Tony Hawk. We had a first party, I think World War II title called Pathway to Glory, kind of an, it was a turn-based strategy game. It was very good. And super deep lore. They spent a bunch of money on, like, really researching everything. And I think there was even still a pack-in manual that had, like, full-color pictures and all kinds of crazy research. I mean, the games and the game experience was great. It was a little weird that it's portrait, but looking at things now with so many cell phone games, I think that was also very early.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, and one thing that I see is that there are a whole lot of Sega games there. In fact, it is clearly Sega that was the number one third-party supporter of N-Gage. Is that because of the relationship that they had? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not completely positive, but I think that whether it was officially part of the deal or part of the, like, hey, we're in this together, let's help each other out. Either way, yeah. There were a bunch of Sega games, and a lot of the network expertise and all of the same early features that I mentioned on Heat.net and Dreamcast were also in the N-Gage Arena, which was our online network. So again, same thing. We had voice chat, we had lobbies, trophies, friends lists, profiles, all that stuff on kind of an online gaming network, and actually even a mobile MMO.
Yeah,
right.
It was called. The technology was called Snap, I believe, Sega Network Application Protocol.
Yep.
That's crazy. Yeah, and another thing that is an advantage for the N-Gage is, while I painfully have had to see just recently the announcement that the Monkey Ball game for iPhone that Chris and I worked on finally is being delisted and removed from the App Store. It's just heartbreaking. On the N-Gage, there is a Super Monkey Ball on that as well, but since it's on cartridge, it's still playable. And so I went to a retro game store. Well, yeah, but it does work. I went to a retro game shop, and they had an N-Gage set up, and someone had traded in a bunch of the games. And you could pop in and out the cartridges. It was the version 2, so that it wasn't a nightmare to do it. And just so cool that those games do exist, and you can play them. I don't know how many people will, but it's neat that you can.
Yeah.
How much does an N-Gage go for?
I don't know.
It was something like $130 or something, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think I still have mine. I have both the right original N-Gage and N-Gage QD.
QD. Yep. what did the QD stand for?
I think we never said. It's just QD. It doesn't stand for anything. I don't know.
Is it supposed to be like it's smaller, so it's a cutie?
Maybe something in Latin, like quo. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
And in terms of interaction with Helsinki, how much marketing was? I'm assuming San Francisco became kind of, or maybe did Nokia have offices all over the U.S. or did they kind of use San Francisco as a headquarters for Nokia, or at least the N-Gage base of operations?
It was sort of neither. It was a weird thing where the kind of global online and web was one part of the company, and then all of the country-based sales offices or like carrier relationships were a different part of the company. So the San Francisco office, we did a lot. We did some online games. We did web and network stuff, very similar to what we did at Sega.com. But we didn't work that closely with the Nokia America headquarters, which were in Dallas, I think. And then there was also a Nokia office in maybe San Diego that did CDMA and one of the other cell phone technologies that I think is not happening anymore. One of the 2G ones. So it wasn't actually that close, but the global marketing, we definitely worked a lot with teams in Helsinki and actually in Singapore. So that, you know, you can imagine like trying to schedule a weekly meeting with San Francisco, Helsinki, and Singapore was tricky. Somebody had to take the late night shift.
Oh, geez.
Someone always lost.
Yeah. I did prefer the 10 p.m. meetings to 8 a.m. ones.
I'm really curious about the GRI side of things.
Oh, yeah.
Were you there during the Jason Citrin era? Was that your time?
Yeah. Okay. I started at OpenFaint. I did a bunch in casual gaming, and then I ended up at OpenFaint right before they got acquired, about 6 months. So, yeah, I worked with Jason. Dan Vishnevsky, who's their CTO, I think he was my tech lead when I was at GRI. Kind of funny story.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like I see him around San Francisco from time to time and, you know, we say hi. But yeah, it's kind of amazing that their story now. But yeah, GRI was really interesting too. Also kind of a similar story, online gaming network. Coming from Japan, they had a lot of really interesting / weird, like, genre Japanese games. There's this amazing fishing game I loved. There's a visual novel of kind of samurai romance with a lot of payment gating. Like, you had to buy the in-game thing to get to the next chapter or unlock it. And similar story. OpenFaint was a online gaming network for cell phones. I think what had happened is, I think before Apple launched Game Center and all of their online gaming features, OpenFaint had created a SDK where game developers could have, you know, the same set of features like presence, matchmaking, trophies, mm-hmm. profiles, etc. And their pitch to game developers was, you can use one SDK and make it multi-platform. And then after Apple came out, then I think we made some kind of wrapper where you could use the OpenFaint SDK, but it would then, if you were on an iPhone, it would make the right calls to the Apple version of leaderboards or friends or whatever. So a few months after I started, then we were acquired by GRI to create the online gaming, the mobile online gaming network for all of the GRI games. So that's what I worked on for a while.
So I remember there was a fierce rivalry between GRI and DNA.
Yes.
And
yes.
They had offices, if I recall, across the street from
yes.
one another.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that was, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we were in 185 Barry, like right near the ballpark, and and the GRI offices were in kind of the north building, and then I think the DNA offices were in the south building in the same office park. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, and similar strategies to penetrate the West, because I know that GRI bought OpenFaint
right.
For the social capabilities, as you just said, and I recall DNA got in by buying NG Moco.
Oh, right.
And
right.
Transitioning that. And what when we were in the Sega side of mobile, we're really surprised by was here we were trying to figure out how to capitalize on the technical strengths of the iPhone, where we had just done things like Monkey Ball and Sonic Dash. And we were trying to figure out, okay, this is like a PSP in terms of power and quality. How do we make great 3D games? And then DNA comes out with Rage of Bahamut. And
yeah.
It's like barely a flash game in terms
right.
of technology.
Right.
And it goes right to number one at the App Store and is super popular. And for a little bit, it was like impenetrable to most people in our office what the gameplay even was, right?
Yep.
But the people that loved it really loved it and put a lot of time, money, and energy into it. And that was something that we were kind of reeling from and trying to understand and study. And I know that a lot of those types of games are very popular from GREE as well.
Yep.
So what was it like for your team to see what was working in Japan and trying to bring those things to the US?
It was, even for us, it was a little bit hard to understand. We were working on the core capabilities. So the game design itself, like as you, I had the same experience you mentioned looking at the games, even as an insider at GREE. But the online features were pretty much the same. So that was a little less hard to navigate. But yeah, I mean, when we would, you know, go to the company meetings and see how the company was doing, it was very challenging to try and understand why is this game the most popular, or what is it about this that makes it so sticky? How can we extend this to American customers? How can we support these kind of features? It was very tricky.
I also wonder how it is that while clearly they had DNA and GREE, this big advantage, seeing the data, understanding what types of games work, and actually having those games that they could localize, and seeing that that could be successful with Rage of Bahamut, nonetheless, neither company was able to keep afloat. Eventually, even with all the resources and big offices in San Francisco and really smart people from both the West and the East, they just couldn't break through and last in the Western market. DNA even had Nintendo that they were working with as partners, and that couldn't save them. Why is that?
I mean, I think part of it was just the economics of new user acquisition. The users you had, you'd want them to stay, and then you had to keep developing new seasons or new, you know, DLC. Well, I guess not DLC, but, you know, new stuff to buy, new in-game purchases. But to get new users, you basically just had to pay. You had for advertising, so you had to pay. You know, in-game ads were very popular, so there would be some pop-up to like switch from one game to another game. You'd have to catch somebody at the right moment, and I think just what I remember is it's just the business model itself didn't quite work. You know, if you can't keep those top few games and it's too expensive to put new people into it, it just doesn't quite work.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was having a hard time. And even with Sega, I remember Japan was having massive success.
Yeah.
On the mobile side.
Yeah.
They had like number one hit, number three hit, games like Kingdom Conquest, Hatsune Miku. There were games
Chain
that
Chronicle.
Just... Right. Chain Chronicle was massive out there. And we tried to bring these things, both direct versions and adaptations, to the West. And they were very polished games that had lots and lots of depth. And they just didn't connect with players. It was hard.
Yeah. We had the same experience at GREE as something that would be huge, top one, top five in Japan. It just wouldn't translate. And then on the homegrown side, at one point, we also acquired another studio who had done, I think they'd done Facebook games. They had a lot of very successful Facebook games, and we were trying to move those onto mobile. Many people were. And it was a similar thing. It was like they would have some success, but it's really hard to get that, you know, flash in a pan, super runaway hit. I think a lot of us in the gaming industry then struggled with that.
Yeah, the luck and timing part of it. I mean, when you look at Supercell, for instance, their Clash of Clans is great, but it's backyard monsters, basically.
Yeah.
And if KIXEYE had been able to move faster to mobile, because they were so focused on the Facebook ecosystem, if they had really been able to pivot, they had the right game. They could have been Supercell before Supercell.
Right. Well, I mean, in Rovio, like Angry Birds was the top, and it was, and you know, until it ran its course, and they could, I don't even remember exactly what happened to Rovio. I mean, maybe there's...
They got bought by Sega.
They got bought by Sega.
Oh, they got bought by Sega. But I mean, probably not at the top, right?
It was over a billion.
Really? Oh my gosh! Wow!
Not the apex. Yeah. Angry Birds are still a thing. They're still angry, still flapping around. I think Sega probably wants to try to do the transmedia thing that they've done with Sonic with Angry Birds. And also, I believe Rovio has pretty sophisticated live ops technology that Sega is interested in.
All right. So maybe that's not a great example then. I guess they're still around and kicking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think timing is pretty critical. Yeah. The mobile market was just moving so fast on so many different fronts. You know, you had, just from a technological perspective, new devices that were just pushing the envelope, and then different types of games being released and resonating. You know, in the early days, it was almost experimentation with the touchscreen, right?
It's
a completely different interface, and, you know, Fruit Ninja was a huge thing, and, you know, stuff like Jetpack Joyride, pretty light experiences from a gameplay perspective, but novel in the way that the user interacted with it. And then combine that with the race to zero. So, you know, we shipped Monkey Ball with the launch of the iPhone or the App Store, and it was a bargain. Was it $19.99? It was like $20.
$9.99.
Right? Which, $9.99, okay, yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It was a $40 console game on a phone,
right.
And it sold really well. And then a year later, it was 99 cents. And then after that, it was just zero. And with that, of course, a brand new business model, which, of course, was already prevalent in Japan, which is why I think you had the likes of Green DNA that were trying to establish a foothold here. But a lot of moving parts and moving quickly. I learned a lot, but I think if I had to do it all over again, I'd certainly do some things differently.
Yeah.
Well, I was the one who had to directly tell Steve Jobs that we were planning to sell Super Monkey Ball for $39.99 on the iPhone. And he said, I'm not going to tell you what to price it. That's your call. But if you make it $9.99, you'll sell six times as many. So,
yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Jetpack Joyride and Fruit Ninja. Those games used OpenFaint.
Oh, wow.
And I think we had a pretty good relationship with that publisher at the time. Yeah, so all of the like high scores and all friends and stuff like that in those games, that was OpenFaint.
Yeah, yeah, I remember OpenFaint. And in fact, I remember having meetings with Jason Citron for OpenFaint for Sega. We were looking at that as a possibility for a while, because I know they were looking at third parties and getting them to jump on board. And at the time, the pitch was, this is like the Xbox ecosystem for mobile gamers.
Right.
Which was really smart. And if I remember correctly, it came from them building a MOBA that had those social features, right?
Yes. Yep.
And now that same team created Discord.
Yep.
So
same origin story.
Yeah. And so Jason Citron must be like Full Sail University's like number one ambassador and representation of what you can do coming out of that school.
Yeah, sure. All you have to do is go to Full Sail, and then you can start two very successful companies.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and I think what made what Jason did so successful is when you talk to him, like, he's a hardcore gamer.
Totally.
He was trying to get the Xbox experience in mobile. That was the whole thing, because he loved the achievement system.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I mean, it is so fun to work in the gaming industry with people who love games. And, you know, I mean, that's one of the things I enjoy about this podcast is, like, let's talk about games, like, back in the day and what's happening, and it's great.
Yeah, it's what you'd be doing anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, I'd love to, I understand that you are a lover and aficionado of peripherals, before we talk about that, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your time at Sony and maybe what you're doing and how you've found that experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. So, I mean, of course, like, I have to caveat all of this. This is only my personal opinion. I'm not authorized and not speaking on behalf of Sony. But, I've been there about 8 years. I'm running an engineering team that works on platform features. So kind of what I mentioned just about loving games, it's so fun to make something and then use it and enjoy it as a user. So probably the kind of most easy to understand feature and most impactful feature that we're currently working on is called Game Help. So we have a way for game developers to indicate like the beginning or end of a level or kind of key moments in the game. And then we can specifically target a help video or a hint that will help you get through some part of the game. So for example, in Astrobot, you want to collect all the collectibles and you just can't find that last one. You can hit the PS button and then go to Game Help and it will show you a video of somebody else playing that, that has that the algorithm figures out is the closest to what you're looking for. So that's one example that's super fun. And
that's cool.
Even as a gamer,
My family and I use that all the time, and we love that. So I have an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old, and Astrobot is a specific example. That's so helpful. By contrast, any other platform, I adore Nintendo. I'm playing Donkey Kong, but I have to go to YouTube if I'm like, what do I do with this ice-making machine? I don't understand it. Whereas on Sony, it's just right there.
Yep.
And that's so handy. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. It's super fun. Yeah, so we work on a number of features like that. And it's really fun. I get to travel to Japan sometimes, which is great. I talk to folks in, you know, our global offices all over, and I'm having a great time.
The travel is so great with the Japanese company that I miss most about Sega, because I had so many chances to go to Japan and Europe. And now I've been at my company for about 8 years and I've traveled to Seattle once. And that's been my travel. It's just not needed. But it's like that is fun to really get a chance to enjoy that culture. And they're so welcoming.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And it's like the importance of the relationship is huge. Like you kind of get to meet them and then you go out for drinks and then you connect in a way that's very difficult to do, you know, just through online calls or meetings or whatever.
I've only ever had one negative experience, and that was when I had to provide in person in Japan feedback for a Xbox Kinect game called Rise of Nightmares, which was a very ambitious horror game tied to the House of the Dead universe. And I didn't like it, and I thought that it didn't control very well, and I had to explain that. And the person that I explained it to looked very glum, and then he said something in Japanese, and the translator said, well, I think we need to find someone who's more in shape to play this and give it critique, because I think you're getting exhausted too quickly.
Oh, sick burn.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. So one other little story on that. I sat down for dinner with the Sonic team, and there was a time in which one of the designers was just studiously taking notes, asking me and the other person from the West questions about what Westerners thought of Sonic the Hedgehog and the series. And they said, we want to know why people don't like Tails as much as Sonic. And I explained, well, I think the problem is his relationship. There's so little tension. He just worships Sonic, and Sonic doesn't even seem that annoyed by it, and there's not any kind of sibling rivalry, which was what we're most used to in the West. I said, but don't worry, people like him a lot more than like Chip, which was another Sonic character. And then one of the women at the table said, I am so sorry to have created Chip.
Oh,
I was like, oh no.
Oh, no.
She was so polite about it, but funny. I felt awful.
Devastating, devastating.
Yeah, one of my favorite or definitely most memorable trips to Japan was actually very early when I was working at Sega. We had, I think this was when Dreamcast was going away and we were doing our multi-platform strategy, or maybe it was even earlier. But I remember we were running the online division, online middleware, and we went to all of the studio heads at the time and kind of pitched them like, hey, you should make an online game, probably, I think for Dreamcast. It'll be amazing. Online is the future. All the Dreamcasts have these 56K modems. And so, you know, we met all of the like studio heads and went into their conference rooms. And they were all smoking and had their admins translating or something. And one by one, you know, we met Yu Suzuki, we met Naka-san, I think Noguchi-san, a few others. You know, I have their business cards, which is like a big, awesome thing. And they were like, oh, okay, thank you. That's a very interesting idea. We're not going to do that. Like,
yep.
One by one, by one.
Except for Sonic Team, they did Choo Choo.
They did. Yeah. But like, they were not like that interested. And I don't know that, right. I don't know that that was our pitch that made them do that.
Yeah, right, right, right. That was probably an instruction from on high.
Right.
Yes, you were going to make a network game to support our modem that's in the box. Yeah.
Right, or maybe it was after that and they're like, okay, we're like, we made Tucci Rocket and now that's it.
Yeah,
that's you can upload your chat at daycare.
Well, that's a, I think that's a good, maybe a good segue just to peripherals in general. We mentioned the Kinect and
yeah.
the broadband adapter. And what's your favorite PlayStation peripheral?
I probably the DDR mat. I don't have one anymore, but like in the PS2 era, kind of like the, I loved those like dance rhythm music games. Those were awesome. And then, you know, you go to the arcades and they have, I think they even still have the Taiko drums and like insane rhythm games. But yeah, that's probably my favorite PS2 one.
I love the iToy.
Have you seen?
Oh, yeah. The iToy is cool. I don't think I had a PS3. Was it? I don't remember if it was PS2 or PS3, but I don't
remember. Yeah, that was PS3.
That was PS3. Yeah. That's the PlayStation I never had. I mean, I'm sure.
Have you seen the arcade machine that's a table flipping game and the controller is a plastic table?
Oh my gosh, no. And
it sets a scene. So you get to pick the scene, like it could be a wedding or something and you play either the role of the bride or the groom and something happens and you're supposed to get angry and flip the table as hard as you can. And that's the action is you're actually flipping this plastic table peripheral, for lack of a better word. That's the interface for the arcade machine and it measures the velocity and like all the, you know, like glasses and plates and silverware go, you know, splaying out all over and you're measured on like how much damage or whatever that you do.
Kind of hilarious. That's amazing.
Well, I hope I'm...
There's not a home version, I don't think.
Yeah.
I hope I'm remembering this correctly and not a home version of this as well, but if I recall, Sega had a urinal game.
Oh, yeah. I played that at the when I went to Sega Japan. They had one operating in the bathroom.
Oh, my God. It was awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has a pressure-sensitive mat that they put inside the urinal, and then you get a display in front of you, and you get to pick your little mini game, and one of it's like, not surprisingly, like a beer-filling game or something. You're trying to fill as many beer glasses, and one's like an accuracy one, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's never has a game been more gender-specific.
Yeah, totally. I think when I visited the Sega offices, there was a prototype arcade game for a dog walking game. You're on a treadmill and then there's like a leash controller and then, you know, you see the whatever mailman or other dog and then your dog like runs away and then the leash kind of jerks and you have to like control your dog somehow. Wasn't there there's some kind of Japanese quote unquote prank where you just like basically poke someone in the butt? And I think there's like a butt poking Japanese arcade game.
That's pretty fantastic. I've shared this story once before on the podcast, but it's worth bringing up. The Feel the Magic team are indeed focusing on all the different things the DS could do, and one minigame allegedly that was a part of the mix that Nintendo nixed and said you can't do it was a game in which you licked the screen. So
I loved all of those kind of single purpose controllers too. Like I remember on the first Xbox they had that game Steel Battalion. I never had it, but I think my friend had one. It was like the crazy, there's like a huge
mix. It was like $100, right?
Yeah.
It was huge.
No, that was closer to $300. That was a big boy. Yeah. And funny enough, they did a sequel that was just Kinect where you had to kind of imagine the controls being there and it was nowhere near as satisfying.
that thing
was awesome.
Yeah.
That's something that like, at the time I was just a journalist making like $30,000 a year and that would be way too much a percentage of my total income to buy. But I wanted it so badly and a handful of editors were lucky enough to get to take home the review version
and
play the game.
Wow.
Yeah, and that, if I remember correctly, was for a Chrome game, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't Chrome Hounds? No, it was Steel Battalion. That was Capcom. That's right.
Yeah, that was Capcom.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the other one I loved is the whatchamacallit? Oh, the fishing controller on Dreamcast.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic.
That was great. Yeah.
I never thought I would like a fishing video game, but you put that controller in my hand. I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, the tension and pulling it up was fantastic. That just really made for a unique gaming experience.
It had the motion control. You'd have to, like, cast. I think it also had, like, a little, like, haptic motor when you caught. I can't remember. But
it was definitely, there was a kind of a slight rumbly type action. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and that actually had, there were three fishing games that controller.
We had bass fishing, marine fishing, what was the
bass fishing too.
Yeah.
Ah, the electric boogaloo.
And ultimately getting to use the keyboard for Dreamcast as a peripheral in Typing of the Dead.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I love Typing of the Dead. I think one of our coworkers went as the Typing of the Dead guy one year for Halloween.
Yes, Scott did. Scott did.
Yeah, Typing of the Dead.
I have
great.
The picture.
Oh, and the bongos on GameCube. I think I had those for a while.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Those were fun.
I recently bought those for my son, who's a retro gamer, because he wanted to get a GameCube and the Donkey Kong Bongo Jump game. And so I'm looking at them right now. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was looking. I think there's a YouTube video of somebody beating Dark Souls with the bongo controller just because.
That is amazing. I cannot even imagine how hard that would be.
I definitely don't think I could do that. Yeah, it's like I mean, I guess there's VR, but, you know, there's definitely there were a lot more peripherals back in the day. I just don't see
it. Yeah, I think the height of it was Rock Band, right? Guitar Hero and Rock Band are the big ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember it was just magical when you could get a group of four people together to play Rock Band.
Yeah.
Even the drums were super fun.
Yes, yeah.
But then you had so much plastic peripherals sitting around in your living room.
Right, right. You have, like, you have your whole music gaming room that can't be used for anything else.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty bespoke, and it was a really fun moment in gaming, and it was pretty remarkable to me anyways, especially being in the games industry, how quickly it just kind of evaporated.
Yeah.
Like, it almost seemed like overnight. I had Rock Band. I had Beatles Rock Band.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Enjoyed having people over to play, and then all of a sudden, like, it's just gone.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's some, like... I was just going to say, there's some, like, never quite made it, but kept showing up at GDC. Like, I think I've seen three different versions of the smell peripheral. I mean, even... I heard somebody talking about it from, like, a year or two ago.
Interesting.
Yeah, when I was in between Sega and where I am now, I was working at a couple of VR companies, and there were always these cool things like additional trackers that you'd put on your knees, for instance, so that you could get the full body motion.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of just the hands and the head, there were vests that you could buy that would give you, through music, just beats that felt like you were getting hit by bullets and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that was probably the context of the smell controller now. Like, before it was to immerse your PC gaming, and probably now it was, like, to make your VR more immersive or something.
Yeah, so lots of attempts, but I don't think there's really been anything as intuitive as just holding a guitar and pressing those buttons. That was so much fun.
Yeah.
And it had the perfect learning curve. It was nowhere near as hard to learn as actually playing guitar, but you could feel like a rock star.
Yeah.
And when you got really good at it, people surrounding you were legitimately impressed, which was part of the fun.
Yeah, yeah. It was super fun.
Drumming, to be good at the drum peripheral, though, you actually kind of had to be a pretty good drummer, I think. I think some people probably backdoor themselves into becoming somewhat proficient at drumming.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was in editorial, Karaoke Revolution came out on PlayStation 2 from Konami, and it was a lot of fun, except the way our rooms were set up, if you were in one of the testing rooms, you couldn't hear from the outside any of the game. So all you could hear is the person's voice, And that became embarrassing very quickly. And of course, people ended up recording those things and passing them around.
unjust.
Yeah. Kind of the opposite of what you want for karaoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love karaoke, but no one loves the sound of my voice.
you need a loud bar and a few drinks.
Yeah. A few drinks for sure. For sure.
Yeah, karaoke's fun.
It does make me kind of sad that at a certain point, arcades were where you were getting these peripheral type experiences, things you just couldn't have at home.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, I think the peak was when the Star Wars trilogy game came out, which was from Sega, and you'd sit down in a cockpit and it really felt like you were in the movies. The level of graphics sophistication was there to where it looked like it was film-like, and just having a cockpit that would just rotate up and down, left and right, felt fantastic. But we just don't see those things anymore. The arcade scene is kind of dead, and so the place where you used to play the things you couldn't play at home, now we just don't have it anymore. If you are lucky enough to find a Dave & Buster's, I think probably every game in there is 10 years old or older.
Yeah. Yeah, the kind of immersive, those immersive experiences, you're right, they're like, they're not, it's harder to find. And
I think they've gone to kind of the amusement park now.
Yeah,
it's true, because if you go to Disneyland or Universal Studios, you'll have games, quote unquote, or game type elements where you're shooting at things while you're riding on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And I guess that is the evolution of it. The new Mario Kart experience actually at Universal Studios is pretty fun.
Oh, that sounds great. Maybe like,
and it's highly gamified, and the lines are massive. It'll take you 3 hours to play for 4 minutes, but it's worth it.
Wow, less dangerous than one where you drive around.
That is a subjective statement. It's worth it,
indeed. But actually, that is a good point in terms of gamifying and having game like experiences. Have either of you gone to Universal Studios and seen the Mario Land?
No, I haven't yet.
Mm-mm.
So they gamify the whole experience where you're wearing a kind of iWatch type of device on your wrist, and you're getting points for doing different mini games throughout the event. And if you get enough of them, you unlock a mega event where you fight a boss and you get another prize. And it's a pretty neat way of doing things. Yeah.
So it's like Pokemon Go meets amusement park.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Disney had something like that for a long time that they actually took offline, I think within the last year or so. I can't remember. It's basically an ARG.
Oh, yeah.
You get a starter pack of cards that you can then take to certain areas of the park, and it would you'd battle creatures or set off little scenarios in these kind of just little nooks and crannies of the park. It was super interesting. I went to Disney World with my sister and nieces several years ago and really enjoyed that. I thought it was really cool.
Oh, that's cool.
That is very cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's super fun. Yeah, I think now for the home version, VR is probably the closest, but it's still like just the friction of moving my coffee table and making sure the controllers are charged. It's like not quite. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just lazy, but I wish it were a little more seamless.
So one thing that I do think is super cool, though, have you seen the MetaQuest 3S that is Xbox branded?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. It's no different than the MetaQuest 3 or 3S. It's just a branding that comes with a controller. So if you already have an Xbox controller and you have a MetaQuest 3, you already have everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided to experiment with that when I was trapped in my bedroom isolating for COVID. And I put Elder Scrolls Oblivion through Game Pass, streaming on the app, just set that up, and it was a gigantic screen in my room. And of course, what's really cool is you can also then see the rest of your bedroom because it's pass through and it's color, right?
Okay.
So it feels like, you know, outside of the weight of the headset, it feels like you just have a big screen in front of you in your bedroom. And then I set up a second screen, also very large, to the left of it with the IGN guide. So as I was trying to find different things, I was able to just look at the two screens, and it was pretty wild. It was a really neat application that didn't require me to find 6 feet in every direction of space and stand up. And so that, to me, was really great. And I just went between doing that and watching Netflix. You know, and that was just probably the best experience I've had using that device. So not playing the specific games, which do require a lot of setup and can exhaust you pretty quickly, but just enjoying it as a giant set of screens was really neat.
Yeah. I mean, I think my two favorite VR games are Res, which also, you know, Res Infinite, kind of going back to the Sega generation, and then Beat Saber, you know, very similar
to
a lot of the rhythm games we were talking about before. But yeah, I think for both of those, I mean, you know, you don't need to do a lot, but I just, you need to have a little bit of room to move around.
Yeah.
Safety first.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I bet that friction is one of the reasons why people just haven't tended to make VR a habit. Because what always happens with me is I'll buy a new headset, and I will play it for 3 weeks, and I'll love it. And then I'll put it in the closet and then ignore it. I was just at the Apple store. We had to finally buy some new MacBooks yesterday. And I started asking some serious questions about the Apple Vision Pro. And my wife's like, no, you're going to love it for 2 weeks and then you're going to ignore it. It's not worth it.
Right. And if it were, you know, $300, that's one thing, but it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That thing's still $3,500.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I mean, the reviews look amazing. I don't know if there's a lot or any specific games for it, but it's pretty. But yeah, it's very expensive.
It's been really interesting to dig into Engage and Gree. A lot of stories people haven't heard about brands that they definitely have heard of. And so for every person that wants that kind of encyclopedic knowledge of games, you're really helping them build that. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was super fun to be on the show, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of them.
And
good to see you, as always, and appreciate you taking the time.
No problem.
And so, Chris, where can people reach us if they want to ask any questions about this podcast or let us know what they thought of the Engage, Gree, and all else?
Oh, yeah, good question. We have a spiffy email address. It's info@gamesasapodcast.com. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think. If you have any questions, comments, character assassinations, send them our way. We'd love to hear it.
Great. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next week.